Northern Arizona. Also turned out to be the only marketable skill I had after I graduated. So I moved to Northern California, and I got a job running what in the trade was called a Hoods in the Woods program for troubled youth, mostly stoners from Berkeley High, and I'd take them into wilderness areas up in the Sierras or down in Big Sur. And we'd do Outward Bound style trips with 24-hour solos, and it was a really powerful experience for them and for me. I had a lot of responsibility to make sure everybody got into and out of the field safely, but also they had an opportunity to have an experience of encountering not only the wilderness on their own for a while, but also encountering themselves. And it was around that time that there was a Tibetan master, Tarthang Tulku. This is 1973 in Berkeley, who had recently come to the United States, and I did a retreat with him, weekend retreat. And he was, his English wasn't very good at all, but he was reputed to have sort of psychic powers. And so we sat this retreat together, and on the last day of the retreat, he did a fairly extensive individual interview with each of the yogis, and we'd never met before. He didn't know me. He didn't know anything about my background. But after listening to me report what the experience had been like, and then sort of giving me advice on how to go forward, he said, you work with people who experience a lot of fear, and you need to be very compassionate with them as you do this work. It's like, okay. Well, yeah. And it occurred to me also that the advice that he was giving me in terms of working with the kids on the Hoods in the Woods program was equally applicable to me as well. You know, that I needed to be compassionate with myself, and because my default mode, you know, is was hypervigilance, always looking out for potential threats, you know, whether to myself or loved ones or to the kids that I was taking out into the wilderness. And it was a powerful experience. And shortly after that, I did my first Insight Meditation retreat with Jack Kornfield and Joseph Goldstein, Sharon Salzberg, right at the time they'd begun to teach together in a wilderness area up in Northern California. And it was on those retreats that I started having flashbacks to my time in Vietnam, but also experiencing them in the sanctuary, in the refuge of the retreat setting. And so the teachers were helping me to say, right, that's pretty grungy stuff you went through, and there is a way to hold it that can help you heal through. And that, we'll see again, had to do with the cultivation of self-compassion and learning how to relate to dying not so much as a horrible thing that's to be avoided at all costs, but something that is simply a natural part of being alive. And the other thing that I began to pick up on in that retreat, it was my first Insight Meditation retreat. It was 2 weeks in utter silence, and it was quite a strict schedule because they had just come back from Asia, and it was pretty hardcore. And I thought what I had signed up for when I was going to start learning to, you know, to do to study Buddhism and to do Buddha Dharma practice was how to chill out and enjoy peace of mind and ease and respite from the afflictive states that arise in the mind. And so at some point, I think I felt like I wanted my spiritual money back, you know, because that wasn't really so much what I was experiencing. What was coming up for me was the most difficult stuff in my life, including this powerful aversion and fear of death and all that. And it really took a while, doing several retreats, doing a lot of reading, hanging with a lot of teachers, to realize that unlike the way we're conditioned in the West, the approach to these experiences within the context of the teachings of the Buddha is not about suppressing them or trying to make them go away or pretend that they're not there. It's about how to relate to them in an expansive and an accepting way that creates the space within which the totality of the experience can be acknowledged and brought in. And learned from, I think, perhaps most importantly. And so I began to do more and more reading, both in the Tibetan tradition and also in the Theravada tradition. There's a lot of places in the Pali Canon, in the discourses of the Buddha, where he talks about the deathless. Talks about death and the deathless. And so I got really interested in what he meant when he was using those terms. And as it turns out, I think, as we pretty much all know by now, if we've done much study and practice, is that in the Buddhist understanding, when we talk about death, it has essentially two different meanings. One meaning is what happens on the physical plane. What happens when the life force leaves the body and the body ceases to be alive? We are compounded things. You know, we arose, we change, and we're going to pass away. And so that simple fact of life force leaving the body is one way to, is one understanding or kind of one definition of death. The more significant and important one that the Buddha taught is the arising and changing and passing away of the self. And in a radical departure from the culture and the religious teachings he was born into, what he said was, this self that we consider to be permanent and abiding and imperturbable and everlasting and migrating from one life to the next and whatnot, said, that's not really so. It's not how it is. What happens instead is that we give birth to the self on a moment-to-moment basis in the mind. And that the self arises and changes and passes away continuously and very rapidly. And so when we find ourselves fearing death, when we find ourselves contracting, when we find ourselves that wishing that things were not as they are, all of those feelings, those thoughts and those mind states, the afflictive emotions, the sorrow and the lamentation, the anxiety and the fear, they all arise from one source. And that source is the constructed self. And so when he spoke of the deathless, what he was speaking about was the experience of life in the absence of the self. And what he said was, that which was never born can never die. So what his teaching is an invitation to experience or examine what it means to be afraid or anxious or sorrowful. Whether it's the fear or anxiety about your own future illness or passing, or maybe that of a loved one. It's an invitation to examine the realm or the environment or the context within which that is going on. So he invites us to use these questions of inquiry, you know, who is afraid? Who is sorrowful? Who is anxious? Who is feeling lonely or abandoned? Okay. Is that you? Is that a permanent thing? Or is that instead the process of consciousness flowing through a certain set of circumstances? Like a stream flowing through a canyon down into a river. Okay. So it's an invitation to think about these feelings not as something that constitute who I am or my mind see at this point in time, but rather as a flow, an infinite flux. So what he said in the Pali Canon is that the stream of consciousness can flow through many different landscapes, many different places, some of which are difficult and afflictive, some of which are beautiful, okay? In the Tibetan context, they teach a parallel but somewhat different construct, and that was the one that is portrayed in the phrases that I recited from the Tibetan Book of the Great Liberation on Hearing in the Bardo. And as I know some of you have heard me talk about previously in our sittings together, the Tibetans have this understanding that the ceaseless cycle of being, dying, non-being, and rebirthing happens in stages, each of which is called a bardo, or state or period of change. Some of the bardos last a long time, during which change is almost imperceptible. Some of them happen very quickly. So this bardo, or the state of being that we're in now, is the bardo of being, the bardo of physical existence. At the time of death, according to this teaching, we enter into the bardo of dying, which is a shorter one, shorter period, happens more quickly, and there's a lot going on. So the phrases in the Tibetan Book of the Great Liberation on Hearing in the Bardo, the misnomer of which is the Tibetan Book of the Dead, because it's not about dead people, it's about process of dying. And so Gyal Rinpoche's masterful treatise on it. It's called the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. So he talks about the ceaseless cycle, you know, not just about death. But at any rate, the phrases in the great book are to be read to someone in the process of dying by a spiritual friend, a monastic, a family member, and the idea behind them is to help the person who is dying do so in peace and do so with a spacious mind, a mind that is not afflicted by fear and anxiety and contraction. Okay. And so also in this understanding, the Tibetans talk about the three bodies, you know, the material body that we're in. They talk about what some called the rainbow body, or the aura of energy that surrounds the physical body, that the spirit can inhabit. And so there's an understanding or an intelligence in this aura that's external and sometimes to the physical body. And then the third body they talk about, the Dharmakaya, is the great Buddha field of which we're all a part, the massive body of the universe of which we're all simply individual cells. And so those phrases that I was reciting are the ones that are read to a person in the process of death, and what the phrases are inviting the person who is dying to do, say, step out of the small self, this body of fear. So it's an invitation to allow the consciousness to expand. So a common experience at the time of death, if one does not have this understanding and this context and this practice experience, is to be afraid, is to be contracted, is to be wishing that this weren't happening, is to be not wanting to leave loved ones. And so it can be frightening and disturbing time. And so the purpose of the phrases and the person reading them and sharing them is to say, you don't need to be afraid. You know, the understanding here, and you know, it's pretty much borne out in a lot of ways by neurophysiology, which is this body, you know, is hardwired to seek pleasure and avoid pain and live forever. And that's just what it's going to do. And so it's important in this understanding to accept the fear body for what it is, not wish that it were not so, not wish that it just would not feel afraid or anxious or sorrowful, okay? But simply to acknowledge that in this physical manifestation, these are the ways that the mind, the discursive mind, is programmed to perform. So it's not to be eschewed, it's not to be rejected, it's not something to feel aversion to, it's something to be understood in a compassionate way. So this invitation to say, you know, acknowledge this body of fear that doesn't want to die, it's afraid or anxious, okay? But it's an invitation for the consciousness to expand beyond the fear body and into the aural body or their energetic one. Okay? And in the Theravada, that expansion is described as expanding into the deva realms, beyond the boundaries of self. Okay? Expanding basically into the Brahmaviharas. You know, the states of mind of compassion and selfless joy and equanimity and open-heartedness. And so you hear in those phrases, step out of the small self, this body of fear, and rest in your own true virtue and wisdom. Rest in the grace of patience. Rest in the dedication and equanimity and compassion you share with all beings. Just an invitation to kind of flow outward and experience consciousness in the deva realms, okay? Consciousness in the Brahmaviharas. So one of the reasons we teach the Brahmaviharas as a practice, you know, while we're down here on Earth, is, you know, this time around, it's so that you can get some feeling and recognition for them, so that at that point in time, you can say, oh, right, okay, I know these places, I know how to go there. You know, experience these things, rest in the grace of patience, dedication, equanimity, compassion. You share with all beings, it's like the birthright of all beings, for that's who you really are. Trust it. And rest in your own true nature. It's an invitation to expand into the Buddha field. So that's a little bit of a taste of this invitation to move from one to the other realm of consciousness or being in the Mahayana. And I'd also like to kind of compare that or put that alongside the Theravada teachings. And the core one here is the greater discourse, or the Maha Sati Maha Parinibbana Sutta. Okay, it's the greater discourse on the Buddha's attainment of Parinibbana. And what that means is final or ultimate awakening, which is to say, awakening beyond the physical realm. And so it's a really long discourse about the Buddha's final days and the things that he taught, the teachings that he shared while he was dying. So the sort of the traditional story is that he had been on alms rounds and there had been a feast prepared, and it was, you know, the monks weren't they were actually omnivores. They weren't vegetarians. What the Buddha taught was that, you know, if a meal is going to be prepared for you, ask that no living beings, and by this he meant animals, be killed in its preparation. And they didn't kill animals or eat animals in their own compounds. But when they would go on alms rounds, they would eat whatever the locals were eating. So, and he was invited to this feast, and one of the dishes that was being served was some pork that turned out to be kind of, you know, wanky. And so the general story is that, you know, he knowingly ate this poisoned meal because he knew he was not long for this world anyway, and he didn't want to be rude. Medical forensic scholars that have looked at this story, because the Buddha lived for quite a long time after he got sick, you know, long enough to share a lot of teachings and meet with a lot of people. So they think what was really going on was some kind of a sepsis of the digestive canal, right? That lingered for quite some time. At any rate, he had plenty of time to check out, and he had plenty of time to gather those around him and say sort of what was on his mind. And the most poignant story, I think, for me at any rate, of what was going on during this period is that there were all these people that heard that he was, you know, probably about to buy the farm here. And so they came around to pay their last respects, and some of them he offered final teachings to. But as he was getting closer and closer to dying, he was looking around for the people he really wanted to make sure that he connected with, that he imparted something to before he passed on. And over the course of his lifetime, from the time he began to teach, you know, about 45 years, till he died, almost half a century, his constant companion had been his personal attendant, his a cousin, and a close, dear friend named Ananda. And as he was nearing death, he looked around and he's asked, "Well, where is Ananda? Please bring Ananda to me." And so someone was sent off to find Ananda. And they discovered Ananda in the doorway of his hut, his little meditation kuti where he lived. And he was leaning against the doorway, and he was overcome with sorrow and a sense of impending loss and loneliness and just incredibly crushed and burdened with afflictive emotions. And he was also a little embarrassed. And the reason was because it was his understanding that if he were fully enlightened and had let go of everything, he shouldn't be feeling any of this stuff. He just should be open-hearted and accepting and la-di-da and whatnot. But that was not the truth of his experience. And so he was really shy. He felt almost ashamed of himself for feeling these powerful afflictive emotions and so much sorrow. And so he didn't want the Buddha to see him in this state. But the people who came to him said, you know, the Buddha really wants you to be there. He really wants you to be with him. And so Ananda came into his presence, and the Buddha, you know, shortly before his death, with a really wide open and compassionate heart, he said, "Friend Ananda, do not fear loss or abandonment or the inability to awaken." You know, because Ananda had been so dependent on him for teachings, and he knew that he hadn't reached final awakening yet, and he was afraid that if the Buddha died, he never would. "Do not fear loss, abandonment, or the inability to awaken. For I have taught repeatedly that all that is ours, dear and delightful, will change and vanish. Such is our nature. The will to awaken is within you, and it will surely happen. Have faith and carry on." So the Parinibbana Sutta then says that very soon after that, Buddha died, passed away. And that among all those who were there, and this included the devas, the beneficent non-corporeal spiritual beings in the basically the energetic aura, okay, and the deva realms are kind of synonymous with the realms of the Brahmaviharas, okay. The devas, the monastics, the lay followers of the Buddha, all those who were gathered around, it is said, basically fell into two groups. There were those who were overcome with sorrow and grief and lamentation and the suffering of afflictive emotions on the Buddha's death. And there were those who simply accepted the Buddha's passing with equanimity and understanding. And by this time, Ananda was in the latter group, not the former one. And at that point in time, just after he died, there was this figure in Buddhist lore. His name is Sakka, ruler of the devas. He was the ruler of the realm of beneficent non-corporeal beings. And it was Sakka who, right after the Buddha first awakened, it was Sakka who came and beseeched him to please come share your teachings with devas and men, with devas and humans, because there are many who have but little dust in their eyes who will be able to understand what it is you're trying to share. And so it was he who basically kind of talked the Buddha into teaching. And Sakka arises again right after the Buddha dies. And he says this, and these are phrases that in Pali are in the Theravada countries in Thailand and Burma are recited on someone's memorial service or on their passing. "All compounded things are impermanent. They arise and they pass away, for that is their nature. Those who understand this truth know the highest joy. All compounded things are impermanent. They arise and they pass away, for that is their nature. Those who understand this truth know the highest joy. So, for me, that's, those words are kind of inspiring, because all they are really saying is what the Buddha said throughout his lifetime. You know, ultimately, it's all about letting go. And this is essentially the final letting go. But it's also possible, and I've experienced this as well, to fall into a kind of a dualistic trap. And by that I mean when I get anxious or upset, you know, I hear that somebody, and I do, you know, I have a colleague, a fellow Dharma teacher actually, who got hit hard by COVID-19, and she's coming through it, but and she was young, well, young, late 30s, early 40s, healthy, a Zen teacher who, you know, is leading an impeccable lifestyle in terms of what she ate and whatnot. And so I found myself in the same boat as Ananda, which is to say, even though I would love to be able to say that, you know, when I hear about somebody becoming ill, when I reflect on, you know, and every once in a while I just kind of run the probabilities, the numbers, you know, in terms of my age and, you know, the fact that I've got, you know, a heart with attitude and stuff like that, you know, that, you know, the odds are a little steeper than the than, you know, the public at large. And that, you know, serious illness and death is a possibility, you know, more so than it was before this thing came along. And so whenever I find the mind contracting into one of those dark places, into a sense of dread or anxiety or fear, or just kind of being bummed out at the whole thing, or just even, you know, like major boredom, when I'm feeling those difficult emotions, this thought arises, just like it did for Ananda, you know, saying, well, you know, if I were further along, if I were more completely realized, if I were more nearly awakened, I wouldn't be experiencing this stuff. Everything would be hunky-dory, and I'd just get up every morning and have my tea and go down and sit and bliss out, and that would be that. But that's not really kind of how it works. And so what I find myself doing when I get into those spaces is to try to remember how Ananda felt and what the Buddha told him when he came into his presence. You know, and the first thing that he told him is that what you are experiencing is your Dharma. It's how it is, right? That having these afflictive emotions and these times is not a symptom of a lack of spiritual maturity. It's a symptom of being human, you know, of being an inhabitant of this fear body that also has the capacity to experience anything, other things as well. So for me, it feels like we're being invited to experience the afflictive emotions with the same kind of open and compassionate heart with which the Buddha taught Ananda in his final moments. You know, he was saying, it's okay. It is what it is in this moment. You know, have faith in yourself. You are on the path, you know, and your final and complete awakening will surely occur. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about what the future may hold in store. All you ultimately need to do is let go. Let go of anxiety about the future turning out to be this or that way, or not be a certain way. Let go of concerns about the future and rest completely in this moment as it is. And the future and your awakening will take care of themselves. So in the end, what I took away from, you know, these final stanzas in the Parinibbana Sutta is that we are our own Ananda, and we are our own Buddha. That it's possible to be the one who's experiencing the anxiety or the fear or the afflictive emotions, whatever they are, and to simultaneously be that spacious, conscious embodiment of wisdom and compassion that knows that it's okay, but fully accepts the other until finally there's no difference between the two. That's it. That's where the Sutta Lake leaves off. Any comments or reflections or thoughts about anything that was said there, please? Coralie? Or no, it's Adrian.
Yes, hey, that was a lovely Dharma talk, Louis, as usual. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. That was a lovely Dharma talk, Lloyd. I liked the description of the, it's like the daily prayer, isn't it? The, I am of the nature to grow old. I like the words compounded, because maybe that was a translation or whatever, but we know now that we're just very complicated ordered molecules in the sea of
atoms. Yes.
And that's where we'll return to, and it won't be the end of the world, because our atoms will just be here in different forms, and that's where they go back.
Right.
It's the more we're learning about our physical environment as humans are learning more and more, and the more universal the truths become.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, that's one of the reasons that the Buddha taught, and that I more often than not actually begin my own meditations each morning doing the four elements like we did this evening. You know, the earth element, the water element, the wind element, the fire element, because that's what you said is exactly what he was trying to get at. You know, we are this compounded thing that's made up of the same stuff as everybody else, you know, and we come together and we're together in this thing, this entity, you know, for a while, and then we're not. And, you know, while we're here, you know, we're breathing molecules of air that may have been breathed by Sacagawea and Einstein and, you know, Newton and whatnot. And then we're going to go back and we are going to dissemble, we're going to disaggregate, and whatever it was that made us up is going to get breathed by somebody else and become another compounded being. And so, right, there's that way, there's that kind of lightness about it that you know, that you touched upon. There were, it's just such all this great unending cycle and circle that we're all part of. And when we can see it that way, it does make it a little bit easier to let go, because all we're doing is letting go into the nature from which we arose and to which we return. Yeah.
We're safe in the river of life.
Quite so. Thank you. Other views, other questions? Well, if there aren't, we can end our set together. Oh, somebody's got a hand up.
Yeah. Let's see.
Luke, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, one thing that occurred to me is that I want to do is become familiar with the physical process of dying, like what shuts down and what happens, so I'll be familiar with it, so when the time comes, I will be less fearful, you know.
Yes, right. You know, I've been with enough people at their moment of death to and talk to others. You know, I helped found an organization in the San Francisco Bay Area in 1975 called the Shanti Project that provided counseling and companionship to people who were dying. And there's no one way to die, you know. People go out in all different kinds of ways. It depends in part on what the nature of the physical affliction was, as to, you know, what shuts down. Some of the more, I think, difficult ones for me have been, like, I have a friend right now is going out on ALS and is gradually losing all physical capability and the ability to form intelligible words, but her mind is just as sharp as it's ever been. And so there's this frustration that arises because she really wants to communicate. We really want to understand what she's saying, and yet the barrier is getting higher and higher. And she's a healthcare professional, and she has decided that she wants to exercise her rights under the Death with Dignity Act here in Colorado. And so we've talked about, what do you think the point might be at which you would want to make that decision? And she said that it's when I can no longer communicate with others. You know, that the sense of loss that comes with not being able to be with others in the way they wish. And so I think that she may be pretty close to making that decision. But, you know, it's different for all of us. It really is. One of the things that there's a book by a teacher that I, whose writings I study a lot these days, and who I sit with when I can, Bhante Anolio, and he has a book on rebirth, and in there he talks a little bit about the moment of death, and it's interesting, you know, he says that he touches on something that really related to our founding of the Shanti Project back in the 1970s, because this is before there were hospices. You know, we were actually among the prototypes for the hospice movement, actually, back then. And the general dominant mode of death at the time. If you're going out on some degenerative disease or other, whatever, cancer or, you know, something else that was taking you out by degrees, the idea was to keep the patient comfortable, which for the most part just meant drugging the hell out of them, you know, so that they couldn't feel physical pain, but then they also, the mind was so dull that they just eventually fell into a drug-induced coma and stayed there until they died. And so what we were trying to do is to provide an alternative model so that number one, you didn't have to die in a hospital with a bunch of tubes in you if you didn't want to. Secondly, that you would be certainly have access to adequate pain management, but to try to do so in a way that kept the mind clear so that you could be communicating with friends and family and loved ones and whatnot until right near the end. And so that organization was co-founded by a psychologist named Charlie Garfield and Ram Dass in the Bay Area. It was basically to try to help people die a conscious death if they wanted to. Right. And so in Analio's book, he says, well, yeah, he said, it's really useful to be able to die a conscious death and to have those with you who can help you do so, who can help you. He doesn't subscribe to the Bardo model necessarily. The Theravadins think that rebirth happens pretty fast instead of through these various stages. But nonetheless, that the state of consciousness at the moment of death is pretty important in terms of what's going to happen next. And he said that by all means, if you can arrange to die with your friends, family, and loved ones around you, great. But he said, none of us really knows how it's going to come down. Yeah. You know, our circumstances are going to be. One of the really tragic things about CV19 is that we all, I think, would love to have friends and family and loved ones around us, you know, but so many of these patients are having to die alone because to have their family around would only infect them. And so he's saying it's not a bad idea, just as a kind of a backup, if you learn some of the phrases from these texts, whether it's the TBD or the classic one, the chant from Sakha, Ruler of the Devas, you know, all compound, and this is the classic one in the Theravada, all compounded things are impermanent, they arise and they pass away, for that is their nature. Those who understand this truth know the highest joy. That if we have those teachings sufficiently embedded in our memories, that again, we can be our own Buddha, we can be our own Sakha at the time of our parinirvana, you know, so that we can usher ourselves out of this world in a state of peace.
Thanks, right? Ed.
Yeah, of course. Okay, Karen, looks like Karen's got her hand up. Okay, unmute, Karen. There you are.
So, in response to what I think I heard Luke say, as far as wanting to know more about just the I think he meant just the physical process.
Yes, yes.
A book that I have appreciated is called "How It's Old: How We Die" by Sherwin Nuland, and it says it. You know, it's all the stages of the body gradually shutting down.
Really? Mm-hmm. How We Die by Sherwin
Nuland, Nuland.
Okay.
I think the book's been around for 20-25 years. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well done. Okay, thank you. Thank you for sharing that.
A similar comment, but unrelated to what Karen just said. We just again watched the movie Gandhi.
Oh, yes.
Remember the assassination scene where he says, "Oh God, oh God, oh God." But I think that reflects what I understand to be the Hindu desiderata of wishing to have God's name on your lips as you die.
Yes.
That is a conscious death.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. It's return to the one. You know, it's like, and that's the way the Tibetans talk about it too. He says that at the moment of death, we return to the primordial light from which we came. Yeah. So it's invoking the spirit of God and also becoming one with it, you know, Brahma and Anatta and being one. Yeah. Very sweet. Thank you. Okay, good friends. We're coming up right on 8 p.m. I want to thank everybody for coming around. It's been really nice sitting with you tonight and sharing some of these teachings of the Buddha. Look forward to seeing you again soon.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lloyd.
Thank you, Lloyd.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lloyd.
Thank you, Lloyd.
Stay safe. Stay healthy.
You too.